From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, this week is shaping up to be at least as hectic as last week in terms of the political scene. Today, we're going to be hearing from a bipartisan group of senators about comprehensive immigration reform. Gun safety review is also up for review in the Senate, and John Kerry will likely get the Senate's seal of approval as the next Secretary of State. Cue the announcements from the rest of the field about running for his seat. And then, of course, tomorrow night is Mayor Tom Menino's State of the City speech. Joining me today for politics, as usual, is Scott Lehigh, a columnist for the Boston Globe, and Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. Welcome to both of you.
Good to
so,
be here.
So I thought the piece in today's Globe really summed it up, Scott, about everybody's just going to be watching Mayor Menino from everything from how he walks to the message of the speech, from the way he delivers it. You know, is there going to be any slurring? Is there going to be any malapropisms? I mean, in the past, that stuff was all kind of part and parcel and sort of acceptable, but it may not be.
It was basically the guts of the speech.
Exactly.
In the past. Well, I think the city is sort of hanging on his every step here, more than his every word.
True.
Because they want to see how the mayor's going to do. I actually am not sure. I mean, we sort of have these events. We make them into big deals. I would imagine the mayor can pull this off. I don't think that is really the test. I think the test is, does he have the energy and can he get out and around? And I mean, here 3 months later, he's still staying in the Parkman House because can't make it upstairs. I think that's not a good sign for a guy who wants to run for re-election. And sooner or later, he's going to have to really sit down and say to himself, hey, is this realistic? But, you know, we'll watch. It'll be interesting to see. And the kind of reception, I mean, I think a lot of people feel good about the mayor and they don't want to just sort of count him out prematurely, though I kind of have. But, you know,
I haven't. Yeah. I mean, but that's part of the deal here, Graham. I mean, people are making special accommodations for the mayor, but they've been doing it all along. I mean, even before his hospitalization, he had issues, mobility issues, and people were making accommodations. They're going to make accommodations for him tomorrow night with the podium by taking it off the stage and putting it basically on the floor of Faneuil Hall. So, I mean, can that continue? I mean, he sort of commands whatever he wants and people jump to it.
Yeah, my question was going to be, even if he was incapacitated to some significant degree, would people still reelect him?
That's a good question.
Know.
I think people actually are a lot less sentimental in politics than I mean, I think there's good feeling about Menino, but I think if people get the idea that he's not up to the job, they're not going to say, oh, let's give him one more term. I don't think voters react that way.
You know, it's interesting to me, though, that there seems to be a lot of fear. He intimidates. You haven't seen a single criticism from, I mean, forget a Boston city councilor, from any politician anywhere saying anything about, you know, at some point your time is up. You know, you've been there for 16 years. Forget giving it a chance to somebody else. You've run your course. You haven't heard anybody say it.
Well, in part, that's because the mayor's very petty. I mean, really.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
Part of his secret has been in office this long. Remember when he told Peggy Davis Mullen she couldn't park her car in a certain part of City Hall? And he's notorious for kind of blacklisting people and, you know, not all of a sudden your project slows down or this or that happens to you or the city won't work with you. And so that's one of his tools. And I've dealt with him long enough that I've become persuaded that it is not just a personality shortcoming. It is a conscious part of his strategy,
yeah, I mean,
the way he manages the city. He'd like to be loved, but he'd rather be feared than loved, really.
We're getting to Machiavelli, right?
Yeah.
I heard over the weekend, Graham, that he actually called Governor Deval Patrick and said, please do not appoint Steve Murphy, who's now the council president, to the sheriff's position, because that will mean Michael Flaherty, his old nemesis who ran against him the last time, would be the automatic person to come on to the council because he had the next largest number of votes last year. So he said, don't let that happen.
Oh, he's always thinking that kind of thing. Yeah.
I believe that, too.
No doubt whatsoever that's true.
Yeah.
He had a good election in November, didn't he? He was slow to give his endorsement, but then it really seemed
Elizabeth
to make
Warren.
To Warren.
Do you think it made all that difference? Do you think it was?
She did very well in the city of Boston. I mean, she won the thing by 8 percentage points, but I think she was up by a couple hundred thousand votes, I think, in Boston.
Don't you think that would have happened anyway in Boston because of the Obama effect?
I think the mayor has a good machine. You call it organization, but a good machine that can pull out votes. And I think you do see it in an election where people are excited and he can get them out. Yeah.
All right. So we all jumped the gun last week on the interim. I mean, on the Senate seat, thinking that Stephen Lynch was officially in. I mean, I think he is. I think the Globe essentially had it right. That's not one of those mistakes that you really have to retract. Channel 5 had the same thing, and then we went with it as well on Friday. But it looks like Steve Lynch is poised to get into the race this coming week. So that would give us a Democratic race with Ed Markey already in. And anybody else, do you think, Graham?
As far as I know, those are the two main people. There's the pediatrician, right, the doctor who...
But he's going for governor.
Okay.
Who's that? Who are you talking about?
Dan Berwick.
Oh, Don
or
Berwick.
Don Berwick, rather.
Don Berwick, yeah.
I was thinking run for governor.
Yeah, that's governor.
I got to say, I don't know about Lynch. He is he's very wishy-washy. And you recall that last time around, when we in the special, he was ready to go and he'd put out his schedule the day before where he was going to be. And then he pulled I think he made assumptions that some people would be with him who wouldn't be with him in the labor movement. And he pulled the plug at the last minute. So, I mean, this is a freebie. Yeah. You get to run.
I can't see this working out for him.
No, it's not going to work.
You think so?
No, I don't know. I mean, he thinks, well, look, a crowded field could have worked out for him. Maybe if he had three or four people in here and he could say, okay, I got a pro-life base and the labor base. But no, I think that people realize that he's not that. I mean, he's kind of a strange loner. Not a bad guy, I don't think, but kind of hot-tempered.
I
just don't think he's not really – is he big enough for the Senate? I think he really isn't, honestly.
You know, one of the things that I've learned is that when politicians do something that doesn't make much sense to me, they're right and I'm wrong. There's a sort of logic to what they're doing. But I was just fascinated in the period when it looked as though Scott Brown would absolutely certainly be running, that the Democrats coalesced on Ed Markey because – I was thinking about who would you want to run against Scott Brown? And yes, Markey's got the money. But here are the two negatives. First, that he's just been in Washington for so long, 36 years. So you could be running against Scott Brown, somebody who, or looked like were you going to be running against Scott Brown, somebody who looked like the consummate Washington, D.C. insider. And second, although he's won a lot of elections and he's won consistently well, I think his lowest vote share was 62%. Problem with that is that in a way you're not experienced in running in competitive elections. So I've just been fascinated by the original convergence on Markey. Mm-hmm.
It was a brilliant strategy on Markey's part, frankly.
You know what's interesting?
He is sophisticated, even if he hasn't run a tough race.
It may be the only bold, really bold political thing Ed Markey has ever done in his life. He jumped right out there immediately and got into the thing. He's habitually cautious, and he's always looking, calculating.
He was hemming and hawing the last time around with the Martha
Coke. Yeah, this time he just got in and did it. And I think he kind of stole a march clearly on Capuano and on Lynch. And there he is, and he's consolidated some support. Now, that said, I mean, it is true. He's been in Washington really a long, long time. He's got a good record. He's got some accomplishments. He's a smart guy. But he also, he's less than compelling, I would say. Compared to Steve Lynch, I think he wins. But compared to Scott Brown,
on. What is going on? Is Scott Brown, what do you think, Graham? You just said that when it looked like he was going to run, now nobody knows whether he really is.
Right. I guess that he's just... I'm trying to understand it from his point of view, and I guess a big part of it is how many times do you want to run in a bruising race in a relatively short amount of time?
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think they also think this. They believe that he could win the special, but could he hold the seat in next year? You don't want to win again this year and then get broomed out again in 2014. Now, the special, you don't have the structural problem of, hey, if you vote for this guy, he might give control of the Senate to the Republicans. So that's off the table. I think that really hurt him last time. But in next time around, you'll have a much bigger turnout. You'll have everyone activated and motivated. And it will be a gubernatorial year with a gubernatorial year turnout.
So you're buying that he would run for governor?
No. I'm saying I think next year the turnout would be big enough. So I think he could win this year, but he might just lose it again, lose the Senate seat again next year. And who wants to do that?
Yeah.
So he's got to, I think, persuade himself that he could actually win this year and then hold the seat when it's up.
Are you buying this idea, though, that he's not going to run this time and he's holding out for governor?
No, I think he'd be an awful candidate for governor.
Charlie
Baker is just a lot sharper, a lot better informed, a much better candidate. I think he would beat Scott Brown, honestly. So I think
Scott Brown is more of a legislator than a leader. I mean, he's I see his appeal. I get that, but I think as a gubernatorial candidate, it takes a whole other skill set.
Yeah, and the bloom is off the rose, really, as far as Scott Brown is concerned. He was he was running sort of as a vote for me because I'm a bipartisan, but I think people came to see that he really was kind of timid and not much of a leader, that he was a strategic late voter and it wasn't having much effect on the Republican Party. So I don't know. I mean, I think people feel good about him, but I think when push comes to shove, he did not make a compelling case. And frankly, he should have used the lame duck session or the time after he lost when he left to reposition himself and to sort of show something, and he really didn't. He seemed small and frankly a little petty. So
as you know from our previous conversations back in the fall, I thought that his campaign was misconceived in the sense that here he was as Mr. Moderate, Mr. Reasonable Guy, but then the campaign became more and more sort of angry and bitter and personal in his attacks on Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I think the bloom is off the rose.
It was a dreadfully stupid campaign. And the problem there is, you can say he's got a bunch of sort of squirrely little ideologues around him who are very tough to deal with and not
really little ideologues. I mean, like that.
No one in the press likes him. They don't have good relations with anyone.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is the guy at the top starts the really sets the tone. And I mean, look, we've dealt with a lot of people, a lot of great Republicans in this state, Wells, Salucci, Swift, Charlie Baker, and you've had good relations with them. They call you back, you get them on the phone, they're in the conversation. That is not Scott Brown. He's sort of scared of his own shadow, and his people are defensive and petty, and it's not a good formula for winning.
Talking to Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh and Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. So another name surfaced over the weekend as the interim senatorial replacement, Mo Cowan, who is the former chief of staff to Deval Patrick. Deval Patrick feels very loyal to him. He's African-American. The governor has said he'd like to appoint either a female or an African-American. What do you think?
I think this is Deval being precious. I think no, you can't. He likes to think he's different. He's outside the system. He needs to appoint someone who knows the job, not a former staffer of his, not Mo, who's a very nice guy, not Jay Gonzalez, who's a very nice guy. Someone who knows the job, who's got some stature, who's got some gravitas.
Paul Kirk didn't know anything.
Well, no, Paul, I mean, I'm not a big Paul Kirk fan either. I wasn't with him. But, I mean, he's a nice guy, too. He was a functionary. He appointed him to sort of fill in for Ted because it was the end of, the Kennedy era.
And he had the Kennedy connection.
There are going to be some serious issues down there. This is going to be a time when big things are decided, and you don't need a guy who Deval can say, look, I made a first appointment here. He needs to put someone in who is ready really to
– like Barney Frank?
Well, Barney Frank is certainly one person. There are three or four who could do it. I mean, Barney Frank could do it. Marty Meehan could do it if he would take a leave. He would be a great guy to do it in the short term. But you don't want to appoint someone just to say, look, I'm the governor and I'm different. I'm not really political.
I said that. I had the governor on the show on Greater Boston last week, and I said, well, you said that you want to appoint a woman or minority. I said, why? Well, what difference does that make? Oh, well, we have to have people in Congress reflect all of the – it's like, I agree. I don't know. It's so political is what it is. It's kind of insulting if you want to get right down to it.
I think there's also the question of what you can reasonably expect an interim senator to achieve. I mean, the Senate may not be the Senate of the 1950s, but I think there's still an element of apprenticeship there. And, if you think back to when Hillary Clinton went into the Senate, there was still the view that she had to play it cool for the first year or two and be respectful and not too forceful. And if you're an interim senator, I don't think that you're going to have much impact other than your vote, to put it crudely.
That's why I think Barney Frank would actually be a good idea, because he knows the system. He knows how it works. I mean, he knows all the different procedures and the way the back and forth.
Yeah, he does.
And he's unabashed enough, and he's smart enough that people down there respect him. I mean, the Senate is not, you know, it's not the Mensa organization, and I think that Barney would go in there and he would have some instant respect because of what he's done. And some years back, he was named simultaneously one of the most partisan and most bipartisan figures in Congress. People thought he could, you know, when it was time to fight, he was a great fighter, and it was time to get things done, he could get things done. I actually think he would be quite a good pick, but I don't think they're going to do it. I mean, it's pretty clear they don't have much interest in that.
I think.
Yeah,
did
you see that very interesting account of Paul Ryan saying that when he went into the House that he got very good advice from Barney Frank on how the place works and how to be effective? And it really was just goes exactly to the point you're making, that Barney has the reputation of being very highly partisan, but there he was, you know, giving good avuncular advice on how to be an effective representative to somebody who is.
I think he is. I think he has been quite effective, really, over the years. I mean, he's not the most pleasant person in the whole wide world to deal with, but, you know.
Hey. Really? Talking to Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University, and Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh. We're talking politics as usual. And I'm Emily Rooney. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. If you're just joining us, we're talking politics, national and local, with Scott Lehigh of the Boston Globe and Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. Did either of you get a chance to see the interview last night with President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on 60 Minutes? You're looking blank.
I have seen replays of it. I didn't see it.
I came in this morning and caught it on you know, on the CBS website.
The Love Fest.
It was. But there was something very genuine about it. I know everybody was sort of positioning it as a political ploy that President Obama was simply endorsing Hillary for the presidency in 4 years. But, I mean, they had a really tough relationship, you know, going into this 4 years ago, you know, coming off that incredibly bitter, nasty campaign. And the fact that this relationship has, it appears anyway, to have genuinely worked as well as it did, really came off. So I wasn't totally schnookered by it, but I thought it was actually really interesting to see them side by side.
I think there was a lot in it that was genuine. And going into this, when she started out as Secretary of State, I kept running into Obama supporters who would say, "Oh, it's only a matter of time before she does something," you know, and before she knifes him in some way or other. There was such low expectations almost about how loyal she would be, and she has been
really totally.
So loyal to him. And of course, you can say that there's a coincidence of interests here, that the only way that she was going to survive as a major figure was through being an effective Secretary of State. So there was a coincidence of interest that probably helped a great deal. But I think it has been interesting how well it worked out.
I got to say, I think also it was key to getting Bill Clinton on board. And I'm one who thinks, and getting the Clintons, or the Clintonistas and the Clinton part of the party on board. I got to say, I think that the speech that Bill Clinton gave at the Democratic Convention for Barack Obama framed the issues in this election more cogently, more clearly than anything else I'd seen, and really sort of started this on the general election track. And so I think that was hugely important, too.
So Steve Cross, of course, asked whether this was a setup for 2016. Here's that exchange.
You guys in the press are incorrigible. I was literally inaugurated 4 days ago.
Right.
And you're talking about elections 4 years from now.
Yeah, and I am, as you know, Steve, I am still Secretary of State, so I'm out of politics, and I'm forbidden from even hearing these questions.
Yeah, right.
Right. Politicians never talk about who's going to run in the next election, do they? It's only journalists who talk about stuff. I'm just obviously being ironic. I think it is interesting on not only Hillary's role as Secretary of State, but on Geithner and a number of the others, that the cabinet secretaries have been really pretty prominent in this presidency. Mm. And just to stick with Hillary for a moment, you think back to the – go way back to the Nixon administration when Henry Kissinger was the national security advisor and was basically running foreign policy out of the White House with Rogers, who was eminently – memorable because he was so unmemorable as Secretary of State, attending the funerals or, you know, or doing ceremonial stuff like that. And it has been interesting to me that there have been a lot of changes in the White House staff. I mean, how many chiefs of staff has Obama been through now? Is it four, I reckon?
Lots, yeah. He clearly is not that great a manager as a president. That, I'm not saying that's the most important quality, but everything you hear about, he doesn't really want to put in a management structure that would work sort of crisp and briskly. He wants to have his two or three key lieutenants in tight with him, and a lot of people end up running afoul of them.
By the way, just to go backwards here for a minute, the Boston Globe is reporting right at this hour that the special election to fill John Kerry's seat will be June 25th, and the primary, if necessary, and that's a big if, is April 30th. If Steve Lynch gets in, it absolutely will be, and then who knows if there'll be one or more people running on the Republican side as well. So immigration reform, this could be it's almost too bad. Healthcare needed to happen, but it's some way too bad politically in a sense that everybody didn't get on board with this 4 years ago when right after Obama got elected, since it was such a big issue in the campaign. But it was too toxic. And it's I guess it's one of those things that can maybe only be addressed in a second term because it's going to be so – once again, it's going to be so partisan.
Isn't this process of watching – isn't it so interesting to watch the process of the Republicans backing away from some of the untenable positions that they got themselves in during the campaign? And we saw that with the fiscal cliff, although, of course, that will come back – those budget issues will come back with a vengeance very quickly. But I think that the immigration one is just fascinating in terms of being willing to face the reality of the millions and millions of people in this country who are not going to go away and have got no clear legal status. So it's a problem that obviously needed to be addressed, but it couldn't be because of the politics and the politics inside the Republican Party. I have to say that I'm still giving a wry smile about the idea of leadership coming from the Senate, because we got used to thinking of the Senate as such a dysfunctional chamber with the sort of instant filibuster that was so easy to do, and the idea that any policy initiatives could come out of the Senate was a little bit strange. But it looks as though the process is often going to be this process of Republican disengagement, of the Senate taking a lead, and then ultimately the House Republicans being able or willing to back off sufficiently for something to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what we're watching is a bunch of different presidential possibilities, people like Marco Rubio on immigration, who are becoming kind of policy entrepreneurs for the reason that they know they need to solve this issue if they ever are going to have a chance to be reelected. They need to put it behind – or to be elected president. They need to put it behind them this term. So you've got Marco Rubio who's got – you know, he's got some – obviously he's got some appeal to the Latino community. He's got the background. He's ethnic. So he says, look, I need to solve this. I need to get this going. We need to get it in a way that, A, placates the Republican base, so I need a lot of my tough stuff in there, but also it takes it off the table as a big issue next time around. And that's his incentive. And we may see a little more of that on behalf – you've seen a little bit with Ryan, who seems to say, guys, we can't continue to argue endlessly over on budgetary brinksmanship. We have to be about something other than that. Now, he obviously is looking forward a little bit to his own prospects. I don't think his own prospects are great, really, but he obviously does and thinks that these are issues he needs to clear and he needs to reorient too if he's going to make that go.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I mean, Obama beat Romney 71-29% among Latino voters. So everybody knows if the Republicans are ever going to survive, they got to change that. Actually, John McCain was on This Week yesterday and was kind of addressing the issue that you were just talking about, Graham, about the Senate kind of taking the lead on this.
Right.
And I think I just want to play a little
bit. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's not that much different from what we tried to do in 2007. Martha, what's changed is that there is a new, I think, appreciation on both sides of the aisle, including, maybe more importantly, on the Republican side of the aisle, that we have to enact a comprehensive immigration reform bill.
Of course, the big issue being, of course, the path to citizenship, which, you know, that was the big breaking point, dividing point, and that has to happen. 11 million people have to figure out, they have to figure out a way to get some of those people, most of those people, legalized in
You're
this,
forgetting
in this country.
Mitch's idea to have them self-deport.
Yeah, sure.
That was what he, you know, I got to say, in 2008, I watched McCain up, I think it was in Hillsborough, New Hampshire. New Hampshire, one of the whitest communities in you know, states in America, and Hillsborough, probably one of the whitest communities in New Hampshire. And he was at a town meeting, and people were just lacerating him on what he had done. And at that time, he was kind of a moderate on immigration. And the idea that there would be amnesty, and there was such anger. And he backed off in the course of that campaign. He'd been kind of a leader on it, was going to strike a deal with Kennedy. And then he realized, geez, I cannot be palatable to this party this time if I'm strong on immigration reform. So he became a borders first guy. Now he's back to where he was, and maybe we'll see a little leadership out of him. I think he does honestly feel that this issue should be solved.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first time I've heard John McCain in a while sound more genuine than kind of angry or kind of pro forma, which is what a lot of his – he's got a very lecturing, you know, tisk-tisk approach sometimes on these talk shows and stuff. And this one, I think, sounded fairly genuine.
Right. And I think one of the themes that is coming out of all the Republican meetings is their realization that they put themselves on the wrong side of demography and that that they cannot – continue to, as you were saying, offend Hispanic voters so profoundly and hope to win.
Hmm. All right. So also this week, the whole gun control is going to come up Wednesday. Wayne LaPierre and Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabrielle Giffords, are going to be speaking at the Senate Judiciary Committee after the Newtown massacre. I mean, this is going to be harder than immigration. Don't you think?
Awfully hard, yeah. I do think it's going to be really, really hard because I think the two sides are talking really at cross purposes with one another. I do think there should be some common ground on background checks and doing that both at gun shows and with private dealers. But the NRA has even dug in against that. So, you know, and then the assault weapons ban is a huge thing with them because they say, look, this is not a term of science. It's a term of art. And now Dianne Feinstein is you know, identified, I don't know, hundreds of weapons that would be banned, and it's just a matter of combination of different you know, different gun characteristics that makes them a so-called assault weapon. So I think it'll be a big battle. I do think you could do something if you were careful and thoughtful about it on background checks. And personally, I like the idea of liability insurance for gun owners because
I
think it would work well.
I like that idea that our state rep had. David Linsky, about locking certain types of guns away, that you're not allowed to keep them in your own home even if you own it.
Well, we have that. We actually have laws like that now. But because no one goes, you know, we're not going to have anyone goes into your house and check. So anyone go into your house and check, excuse me. So they're not really enforced except after the fact. But if your insurance company said, look, you got to prove to me you have a gun safe and you have a lockbox for your ammunition, and you showed them receipts and da-da-da-da-da, you might actually pursue that course
behavior.
But
if you start that off-premises, not even having it, you know, you can't even have it in your own home.
That you would have to drive somewhere.
Yeah. I can't imagine gun owners would like that much, really. But,
right.
It's weird because there is a Second Amendment right here now, according to the court. So, and I think a lot of libs like to say, well, yeah, the Second Amendment, but let's just go ahead anyway. And you do have to say, for a long time, we didn't really have any Supreme Court ruling that was clear on it. Now we do, and you might disagree with it, but that's kind of the law of the land. So you have to acknowledge that, and that's hard for the liberals to acknowledge. And the conservatives are just out of their mind over the idea of any kind of gun registry or banning of this product or that. So I do think they could come together on background checks, but the NRA is playing its usual sort of pugnacious rally the base, raise money role there rather than doing anything responsible.
Well, there really isn't much incentive for the NRA to compromise because, you know, the more they rage, the more members they get.
Exactly.
It's good for their business. I agree that background checks might get through. I think that there might be something on the size of ammunition clips. I think that's the and I would be astonished if
it's pretty minor when you get right down to it.
I'd be astonished if a comprehensive ban on so-called assault weapons went through. Yeah. I just can't
but
see
I mean,
that.
You know, if you have a clip that can fire off 20 rounds as opposed to 60, and it's like you can do a lot of damage. I mean, yeah. what's the cutoff?
Well, they're talking 10. You know, that's something you could do, but again, if you had liability insurance and said you had to have this policy mm-hmm. to buy the ammunition, it would kind of do the same thing in terms of, I mean, that's the way a modern society deals with risk, and to me it makes more sense really than regulating individual
you
products.
Think about it, you have to have insurance for your car.
Why yes, not? You do. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, you were saying how liberals ignore the Heller decision and how that established an individual right to gun ownership under the Second Amendment. But you also hear stuff said on the other side, which is also a little bit wild. You'll hear people say, you know, you can't tell me what gun I can have. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, the Heller decision.
You can't have uranium. There's a lot of things you can't have.
You can't have anti-tank guns. Right, can't have heavy machine guns, etc.
Yeah, they badly misrepresent what Heller said as mm-hmm. well. I mean, and Heller, and there's been a subsequent decision too, but it clearly did not say this is an absolute right, and you can do anything you want. I got to say that the gun lobby. They're so over the top on this. They just don't give any ground. You look at the NRA membership, and most of them, if you believe the polling on it, most of the membership seems to be supportive of some kind of more restrictive measures. But they don't have a responsible voice at the top because of the sort of bifurcated leadership structure in the NRA. And the people who are on the board, like people like Ted Nugent or the kind of nitwit, second-rate rock and roll guy with a canned hunt place out in Michigan. I mean, it's pathetic that a major organization in American politics would have the kind
Works
of whack jobs that those guys have on their
Works
board.
Works for them. I'll tell you the part of this that is not going to work is this mental health check. I mean, you can never account for somebody – you know, for lack of a better medical term, going bananas. I mean, it's just that's what so many of these horrible shooting sprees have been. It doesn't, you know, what is a mental health check?
Well, let's say though you've had an interaction with the system, and right now it's very limited what you can put on the records. But let's say they agreed to extend it to where if you were at college, say, or at work, and there was a serious concern about your mental health, and that was registered in some way. Clearly the Virginia Tech shooter mm-hmm. under that kind of circumstance would not have been able. He would have, if you'd had that kind of restriction in the background check, and that will be a big thing with the gun lobby because they'll say no, that's someone's independent judgment or someone's subjective judgment on you. Rather than the system adjudicating mm-hmm. it. But if you did have something like that, he wouldn't have got the gun. And Jared Longner would not have got his gun. So there would have
been. This guy, Adam Lanza,
he would have got the gun. But if his mother had kept the weapons in a responsible way, the way she might have, if she'd had to have liability insurance and a lockbox, maybe he wouldn't have got it. That's harder to know. But there are some things. You tend to get this idea from the right that nothing can be done, so nothing should be tried. And I think that's just wrong. I think it's irresponsible.
Or alternatively, that we should end mental illness and then that will take over the problem.
Right. Yeah. Dr. Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University and Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh. And now it's time for our lightning round. What did you all think of Sarah Palin, who's been a paid commentator at Fox News for, what is it, 3 years, 4 years? Anyway, she's out. My guess is that Roger Ailes says, you know what? We're not getting a bang for our buck anymore. She was probably making a pretty good penny for very few. I never even saw her. And I flip around. I probably watch as much Fox as anybody, especially at night. You know, I always check in with, you know, my pal Bill O'Reilly. My pal Sean Hannity. No, I check in, but I haven't seen her in a long, long time.
She didn't really have much by way of stunning insight. And I'm amazed that there was a time in American politics when people thought she would be a serious presidential candidate. Now she's going to go off and do her thing. I saw that she said that the Republicans had to expand the message and the market they were speaking to. And she went on it was an interview with Breitbart, whatever it is, kind of another right wing site where she sort of brought that stunning realization.
I was surprised that she was still doing the job. My reaction
there
is
you
yours,
go.
You know, that I hadn't seen her quoted. I hadn't heard anything she'd said. You know, it was,
All right, lightning round continuing. Two longtime senators, especially Tom Harkin of Iowa and Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, are retiring. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. You know, Tom Harkin, I respect him tremendously. What is he, 78 years old? He's not that old. Or maybe he's 80, but he said he'd be well in his 80s by the time this term, the next term finished, so he's not going to run.
And your point is, why would that seem extreme in the Senate?
I know. It's just sane. You know, it's just whoever says they're not going to.
Yeah, this is more serious for the Democrats than for Republicans, right? Because Iowa is going to be tough for the Democrats to win next year, and they do have they've already got seven more seats to defend than the Republicans. So, I think this is another serious issue for the Democrats.
Yeah, I'm going to miss Saxby Chambliss. I love the name. I mean, it's a classic.
That's a good reason to miss him.
He actually was a guy you could get on the telephone. He was sort of a reasonable guy. He was part of the Gang of Six who wanted to do more revenue. The Democrats hate him because of the campaign he ran against Max Cleland. Mm-hmm. But
why is he retiring?
I don't know. I think he just says there's, you know, what the chatter you hear is he thought he was going to get a primary from a hard right guy, and he just didn't want to go through it. But I really don't know if that's true or not.
All right, Reese Priebus. I'm finally getting to say his name, so I'm glad he's continuing. He's going to keep his national GOP chairmanship. He's not nearly as colorful as what was the guy, Steele? Michael Steele.
Right,
that guy was
right,
really
yeah.
out there. He was more fun, Michael
he was
Steele.
More fun. I guess it's, you know, I mean, the Republicans have met in holy convocation, and they seem to have decided that that their message was okay. They just have to be more cheerful about it. Maybe they rewarded him for a job well done. I don't know. I don't think he did much as party chairman, really. I mean, he didn't. They can't say this is a stunning success, but he seems to be kind of a placeholder there, and I guess maybe all the factions are content with him.
I just want to go back very quickly to these people leaving the Senate, because it does interest me that both people are retiring for just because they're retiring, or like John Kerry, they're very willing to, mm-hmm. or Hillary before him, very willing to get out for a top cabinet position. If you go back and read the books about the Senate in the 1950s, one of the defining features of life in the Senate was people saying to each other, this is the best possible place to be. There's nothing
sure.
better to be than a United States senator. And I think that there is probably a fairly high frustration level amongst senators in terms of
no, you hear
what
that all
it's 100 jobs. It's one of
no,
the
best. Yeah,
it
is so miserable. You get nothing done, and everything, you know,
you're
everything
so important,
is,
and everybody's you know, ride your own elevator.
You're so
and
self-important.
Well, I give them credit for giving it up. I would think it would not be an easy thing to do.
It is kind of both a job and a nursing home all in one, I think, which is appealing for some of them. But I think that Graham's absolutely right that there's a huge – I saw Newt over on the weekend on one of the shows, and someone said, are you going to run for the Senate? And it's exactly what he said. He said, it's such a miserable place. You talk to people in the Senate, no one is happy, and I think that's largely true.
Well, nobody wants to give it up either. All right, Pataki to Graham Wilson, chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University, and Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh, and that is our politics, as usual, for this Monday. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Edgar B. Herwick III is here.
How's
I know
going,
you're
going
to be talking sports, but get into this. I've got Terry Francona tonight. 7 o'clock.
On Greater Boston?
For the whole half hour. Yeah.
You're going to be talking with Terry Francona. Yeah. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be fun. Unfortunately, I think that the segment coming up now, it will be substantive, but I don't know if fun is the word. It's pretty tough to be a Boston sports fan right now. We had the Patriots losing last week, and Rondo is now out for the season with the Celtics. We found that out yesterday, so we're going to open up the phone lines.
But you got this Bro Bowl thing going on. I was kind of slow to figure that out, but I actually like that story.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines, let people vent. We'll talk about sports like we do most Mondays here on Boston Public Radio. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
And I'm Emily Rooney. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.